in Filipinos in the streets of Manila had established a new democracy.
We have 30 seconds.
His loyalists met, and they seized the Manila Hotel, and they shook Philippine democracy to the point that there were a succession of major coups, armed coups, that really shook the Philippine democracy. And what I learned from this is that democracy is very fragile. And that January 6 uprising in Washington, D.C. was a coup, and it has shaken our democracy to the core. And we have to be very serious about reconstructing our democracy after that episode.
We will leave it there, but so many other issues to discuss. Alfred McCoy, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His newest book is out today. It's called To Govern the Globe, World Orders and Catastrophic Change. Happy belated birthday to Kieran Krug-Meadows and Ishmael Darrow. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Did you miss the Afro-Caribbean and Reggae Marathon? No worries. You can go to kboo.fm/ACR to listen to the archived show. You can also snag a limited edition KBOO Afro-Caribbean and Reggae hoodie before November 20th to show your support for the music and the programming you love. Again, you can catch the Afro-Caribbean and Reggae Marathon and snag a limited edition hoodie at kboo.fm/ACR.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring for a web and new media coordinator. Our web and new media coordinator is responsible for KBOO's website and social media accounts. Applicants should have experience administering a CMS such as Drupal and experience administering a MySQL database, including backups and queries. For a complete job description and instructions on how to apply, visit kboo.fm/employment. Applications are due by November 17th. KBOO is an affirmative action and equal opportunity employer.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8:01 a.m. It's Tuesday. It's time for Too Much Information with your hosts, Tracy Simmons and Abe Proctor. Stay tuned.
All right. Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. And welcome to Too Much Information, as Sonya puts it. I think we should say it that way from now on, Tracy. Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. My name is Abe Proctor. Joining me, as she does every week, my co-host, Tracy Simmons. Good morning, Tracy.
Good morning, Abe. Good morning, listeners. Much information is right. I mean, it's just too much going on at any given moment to cover everything. And, of course, we're seeing, you know, all kinds of things happening at the same time, and it's dizzying. Let's focus on something today, Abe.
Let's do focus on something today, Tracy. I like that idea. We're going to focus on a couple of trials that are underway that have the focus of the nation, or at least a significant part of the nation, particularly the part of the nation that likes to walk around carrying guns. It's commanding their attention right now. The first is the trial of boy murderer Kyle Rittenhouse in Wisconsin, whose trial has just entered jury deliberations, and the other is the trial of the murders of Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia, whose trial proceedings are still going on. Tracy, tell us a little bit about these two cases.
Of course I can. You know, what's interesting about both of them is that they were happening at the same time. The world, or at least most of us, were reeling from the revelations of the George Floyd murder, where we know what the outcome of that trial was. But, you know, there's, of course, a shooting of Jacob Blake in Quinoca, Wisconsin, right after the revelation of George Floyd. The residents of Kenosha came out in protest. They were marching for Black Lives. We saw Kyle Rittenhouse be driven across state lines to Wisconsin with a weapon of war to show up at that protest, and ended up killing two and injuring one other. In the Ahmaud Arbery situation, of course, he was a person having what his family has characterized as some mental health challenges, but he was seen by some folks in a home that was being remodeled, and you know, there's speculation on whether or not the home had been burglarized before. It had at some point. We don't know who actually had burglarized the home, but this is, you know, now part of the fact pattern of the trial that the folks who responded to Ahmaud Arbery's presence at that home thought they were protecting the home and the homeowner, and proceeded to get into a scuffle and ended up shooting and killing Ahmaud Arbery, who was an unarmed black male. Of course, this, you know, became part of the larger construct of, like, you know, Black Lives Matter. What is happening here? In the Jacob Blake trial in Kenosha, there was also a trial there, and the police officer who shot Jacob Blake 7 times in the back was basically let off in that trial, found not responsible for that murder, which also is, you know, telling, right? You have shot someone 7 times in the back and you don't even get a manslaughter conviction. That's pretty disturbing. But here we are, you know, seeing both of these trials happen simultaneously. And for me, the pulse is high because we've seen in both cases just injustice happening in real time. So in right now in the Rittenhouse trial, we've seen, you know, a judge wax poetic about is the Asian food going to be delivered? Is it coming from China? We've seen the judge wax poetic about his, you know, tablet or, you know, phone and who's texting him. We've seen him, you know, admonish the prosecution in ways that just doesn't really make sense. For procedural mistakes that have been made. But, you know, we've also seen basically a selfie with the judge and Kyle Rittenhouse. So there's just this interesting, you know, there's so many questions, but the first is, right, what we've seen in the judiciary with Trump and others putting people into that space. And then we have to ask, right, are judges really impartial? Just like other elected officials, they have to win elections. They have to talk to the right people. They have to get donations for their elections. And what's interesting is what we're seeing is a fully partial judge who seems like, you know, he sees Kyle Rittenhouse as his own son and he's part of the defense. We've seen, you know, other things happening in the courtroom, including a fake breakdown by Kyle Rittenhouse. I would call it fake. I didn't see any tears, but, you know, just bumbling and stumbling, and it was almost, you know, laughable to watch. But, you know, proclaiming innocence, proclaiming self-defense. And I guess, you know, the conversation, you know, it has so many different angles, right? We have the guns and people who think that you should be able to carry guns. And then we have the protests and what people think about Black Lives Matter as it has been demonized over the past, you know, year and a half since George Floyd's murder. We have the conversation about the judiciary and what's happening there with very, very partisan people being put into quote-unquote nonpartisan positions to actually be the person who makes final determinations on what happens in cases such as this. And then we have, you know, the defense in the Ahmaud Arbery situation, the McMichaels trial, the murderers of Ahmaud Arbery, who's telling folks, you know, we don't need any more black pastors in the courtroom, that having black pastors present will somehow sway the jury, right? And so there's the racism of it all, there's the white supremacy of it all, there's, you know, Second Amendment, there's so many hooks into these conversations. And, you know, I just kind of see what's happening in front of us and I go, what in the heck?
What in the heck? Yeah, it is indeed, it's indeed pretty instructive for anybody who perhaps has been sleeping for the past several years and has awakened and is suddenly curious about this term white privilege that is being tossed around more and more often. Both of these trials are in microcosm, a buffet of all the various flavors of white privilege and of male privilege as well. And we're going to get into some of those today. So that's one reason that I think a lot of folks are paying attention to these trials. The other, Tracy, is, and I think this one is going to have more profound implications for us in the near future, is that members of the armed right, the people who like to carry guns around the public in states where that is permitted, people who like to carry guns to political events and protests like Kyle Rittenhouse, or the folks who went to the march in Charlestown, West Virginia, what is that town in Virginia where the university is? Charlottesville, thank you. Like many of those people. They're watching the outcome of the Rittenhouse trial in particular because the verdict there is going to send a very clear signal to those people, and it's going to answer a pressing question in their minds. And that question is, when are we allowed to use the guns? And here's what I mean by that. There's a column in the Philadelphia Inquirer by Will Bunch, a wonderful writer, highly recommended. This one was published on the 31st of October. And in it, he talks about a recent event hosted by the conservative pundit Charlie Kirk, who's associated with a group called Turning Point USA. A man stands up and asks Kirk a question. And this is what he says. I'm going to read you directly what he says to Kirk and the rest of the audience. When do we get to use the guns? Yeah. That's not a joke. How many elections are they going to steal before we kill these people? Now, Kirk, to his credit, denounced the man's statement, but not because it was abhorrent and violent and repulsive on every possible level, but no, he denounced the statement because he felt it was playing into the liberals' hands to make statements like that. So this is what the gun-toting right is waiting to see signaled in the context of these cases. When are we allowed to use the guns? Kyle Rittenhouse is acquitted for crossing state lines as an underage citizen, bearing a military-style assault weapon, and then proceeding to murder two people and wound another in a quixotic attempt to defend property from what he believed were looters and rioters. If he is acquitted for that, then we can expect to see a lot more of this in the months and years to come. So that's why the gun-toting right is watching this procedure so quickly or so closely. Tracy, this is frightening. This can absolutely turn the tables on what we have come to understand as legitimate political discourse in this country. And I say that knowing full well that those tables have already been turned over a couple of times in the past several years. So where do we go from here? What happens if Kyle Rittenhouse is acquitted for killing two people?
Well, that's what's really concerning, right? Because if he gets acquitted, I'm sure there are going to be a lot of people really upset about that, in particular the families of those who have been killed. But of all those people who were at those protests who have said they reacted to Kyle Rittenhouse because they saw him as an active shooter, right? And so for those folks who experienced that, I just imagine there will be more protests. I imagine there will be an uproar of just anger for anyone who's watched that trial and seen how partial the judge has been, that they're going to want to demonstrate, they're going to want to express their anger and sadness that this person has not been held accountable for their actions. And so then what do we have, right? Then we have more Kyles that show up to the space and potentially more people who end up dying at the hands of a person wielding a gun. And, you know, it seems like it could potentially be a real, you know, unfortunately, terrible turning point for this even larger conversation about whose right it is to protest, what kind of protest is appropriate, what does protest do for the discourse, and who gets to say when it is self-defense, right? Because, I mean, if he had shown up to, say, the Susan G. Komen breast cancer awareness walk with a military-style rifle, would people even be having the same conversation, right? But because we had news members, you know, at those protests labeling people as rioters and looters, now we have the person who comes in and wants to be the hero and protect other people's property. I mean, this is not even your property. What are you even doing here?
You don't even live in the state.
Exactly.
Your mom drove you to the rally, Kyle, so you could shoot some people.
That's basically what it is, but it also gives us this question about, like, what is self-defense, and who is afforded the right of saying when they've shot another person who is unarmed and killed them that it's self-defense, right? We've seen that in, I mean, so many other trials, right, where just having a black body presence is so scary for another person that once that person is shot, it's like, it was self-defense. I was afraid for my life, right? And how often that works for white, you know, accused people versus how that never works for black and brown people who are accused, right? And so even the question of what self-defense is at the forefront of this. And for folks who tote guns regularly, right, now it becomes an easy trope, right? There's lots of provenance and lots of, you know, experiences where people have used that and it's worked. And so it just also, there's a checkbox there. I go shoot somebody. I already have my gun ready. I'm excited about that. I go shoot somebody and then I say, I did it in self-defense, and see how often that works.
Yeah, exactly. This hinges legally. All of this hinges on the concept of what does and does not constitute self-defense. And if these defendants are acquitted in these two trials, that is going to expand that balloon of activities that are safely considered to be self-defense to encompass shooting your political opponents at what should be peaceable rallies, under the parameters of the First Amendment. So if that's what self-defense means, we're going to see a lot of more gun-toting right-wingers defending themselves in areas that also simultaneously, by sheer coincidence, I'm sure, happen to contain large numbers of protesters, many of whom might have considerably more melanin in their skin tone than the people carrying the guns. That is what this is pointing towards. So we should all be paying very, very close attention to the outcome of these trials. I know I'm not alone, Tracy, in saying this, is that I don't feel as safe anymore going to a political protest as I used to, not only because the police have shown themselves time and again willing to crack people's skulls if the notion takes them, but also now because you can reasonably expect to face armed political counter-protesters. This changes the complexion of political discourse in the United States to something that, in my mind, is ultimately untenable. How do you continue to function as a representative democracy when the political activities of one side of the equation are subject to physical intimidation, menace, and even death? How do you do that? I don't think you can. This is corrosive to the body politic. And if these court decisions go down in the way many people fear that they will, that's just going to be dumping a whole lot more solvent on the machine. And I, for one, I'm worried about it, Tracy.
Well, I mean, I don't even think you can say that statement without also noting who the police are on the side of. Right, right.
Right. So I thought that was implied. Yes, let's spell it out.
Who fail to protect the rights of certain people who are protesting and continually protect the rights of other people, oftentimes in these situations, such as marching for Black Lives, the counter-protests, right? And so what you have also is, you know, I'm not going to do anything about those people. We saw not that long ago, of course, when, you know, the neo-Nazis took over the Kmart and Park Rows, right? The police basically saying, we're not getting involved. And by not getting involved, right, who are they protecting? Because we have a group of people who are armed and the rest of the people unarmed. And so what you're saying is, if you get shot, that's your problem. Just don't show up, right? And it is a lack of protection, of course, for the people in this case who have the most to lose in a situation where there is injustice, right? Right. So the police are not on the side of social justice in these cases, and it's shown. And right now we're seeing that the justice system is also not on the side of the people fighting for social justice.
Yeah. And the corollary is this, too, is that if they're feeling more menaced, lefties and folks of color and social justice advocates and everybody else who's been out protesting recently, you know, they might feel like perhaps packing a little heat themselves. Right? I mean, this is how this sort of thing escalates. It's, yeah, this is a bad situation with the potential to get a lot worse. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Let's go to Cody. Good morning.
Good morning, Tracy and Urist.
No, it's Abe.
Abe. I remember the show years ago with your old partner. I got 2 points. One of those is for the culture in the South and how there's a lot of political incest in the South that works around Black people, descended of slaves down there, and how there's a lot of winking and nodding and a lot of secrets concerning the Aubrey case that no one's really investigated because the secrets are getting too close to exposing some old issues that American descendants of slaves had to deal with in the South with the Ku Klux Klan, and how a lot of the Klanmen just dropped the title and they just held on to the power, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And what I mean is that the three gentlemen, at least one of the gentlemen, were connected to so many city leaders and judges that a few of the judges had to recuse themselves from that case because this is how much the political incest is going on that people aren't aware of, that I'm kind of surprised that no one's really investigating to this day, like 50 plus years after the death of Martin Luther King. And I say that because Martin Luther King was dealing with that type of in-your-face power segregation. And he got shot in the head for exposing that type of secret. It's not necessarily society. It's just, it's more like a feudalistic system that's still trying to hold on in the old Confederate South, and really a lot of cities, you know, like Ferguson was basically that same issue. And that's my this is my segue into the next system concerning what happens with a municipality. Let's say Ferguson, when that went down, no one really talked about the incest that was going on in their judiciary, in their system, and their police department concerning how they were pulling money and taxes out of that area over there. And there's a lot of winking and nodding and a lot of political incest going on over there that no one really looked into. And this is something I'm kind of surprised that Black Americans don't look into, because I'm going, don't you guys see the power disparity and a lot of this stuff going on? Like, whenever I see a police officer shoot a Black person under questionable circumstances, and that Black person is dead, and this police officer gets to go home to kiss his wife and to hug his children, I say it's not just that police officer. It's the court clerks, it's the judges, it's the prosecutors, it's everybody in that city government that basically put that cop up and told that cop in so many words, don't worry, we got your back, you have a license to kill under the right circumstances. So while everybody's giving that cop a hard time, which he should, no one's talking about the court clerks, no one's talking about the dispatchers, no one's talking about the people behind the scenes that's winking and nodding. We're right back at that winking and nodding culture that Black people, I'm kind of surprised, aren't talking about. I'm not surprised that non-Blacks aren't talking about it, but they see it, and then maybe they take it for granted, and they don't bring it up. And last point, with Rittenhour, he shot, 2-3 white males? And I think what it is that people want a type of even justice, because there was a black woman in Florida who was under an even more polaristic situation, and she used her firearm as a form of self-defense, and they threw her in jail anyway.
Yes, they did.
Of course.
And it was kept completely quiet. The press didn't say anything. And as far as the press is concerned, I still got no love for them because they've been throwing black Americans under the bus for a very long time. Now, conveniently, they're bringing this stuff out. But, and I think what it is that a lot of black Americans are really upset that if Rittenhouse was a visibly, I mean, I don't have nothing really against Rittenhouse. He did what he had to do, but then there are a lot of black people who have to do what they have to do out of self-defense. And they don't get the same quality.
Rittenhouse didn't have the same quality of Kenosha and shoot someone.
Well, it's tricky. And I mean, you know, you're right. All I'm saying is that when someone has to kill another person under self-defense, and it has to do with someone who lacks the political acumen and power to protect themselves, even if the law is on their side, it doesn't prevent them from going to jail. And I think a lot of black people resent the fact that Rittenhouse is getting a fair trial. That's all. I think people say, you know, if that black woman in Florida who pulled her gun out, she had to get pardoned because it was that obvious by a right-wing president. Okay. And this is something no one wants to talk about because it gets too close to a deeper truth. We're pointing at people, and we need to actually talk about, let's talk about the court clerks. Let's talk about the dispatchers. Let's talk about the people behind the glass window who does all the paperwork, who's winking and nodding at that police officer who shot that person under questionable circumstances. I'll let you guys I'll let you guys run with it again. I'm out.
Thank you. Thank you, man. Excellent call. What's your take on that, Tracy?
I mean, there's a lot of winking and nodding, and I think this is where, when, you know, people talk about, you know, racism in the justice system, it's not just cops. It's on every level. And on every level, people of color are likely to get the worst deal of all, right? So they're more likely to be pulled over. They're more likely to be put in jail. They're more likely to be convicted. They're more likely to be on probation or parole. They're more likely to, you know, all of these things, right? So at every level of that justice system, there's a different outcome for black and brown folks than there are for white folks. And that's just the reality of it. But we continually are gaslit and told that there is no systemic racism within the system, right? And so we've been calling and asking for a long time for, you know, an overhaul, a redesign. I'm not sure what you want to call it. Of course, the defund movement was, you know, told to us that the slogan sucked, whatever. Right? So this is going on. It's been going on forever, since time immemorial, that there is this, you know, conversation about how the justice system is not just for everybody. That's just a given, right? I think we all know that. But there are folks who are so in denial that are still at the space where they can't say that this system is completely biased towards some and against others. I mean, I totally agree with the caller on that. Cody mentioned, though, that, yes, it was three white men that were shot. And, you know, my assertion is that the most dangerous thing for white supremacy is for white people to fully reject it in practice, in policy, in ideology, right? Like mm-hmm. if white people were to say, we are not superior to anybody, all humans on this earth and in this society deserve a fair chance, they deserve to have resources, they deserve to have opportunities, right? The whole ideology and practice would crumble, right? If white people writ large just rejected it. And so in this situation, and this is why I believe that Kyle Rittenhouse has been venerated as, you know, a hero for some, is that he's a symbol for white supremacy, that we are so married to this ideology that we will kill even people who look just like us who don't fall in line with it. And, you know, I think there are, you know, I don't know if y'all see the Kyle Rittenhouse memes and A lot of them are celebrating what he did. And to me, this is a symbol of them really wanting to make a statement. White people don't show up to those protests. And it is also putting fear, right? And I heard you say this, Abe. I'm scared. And, you know, as a white person, your fear sometimes is the core of everything. Everyone's, right? I mean, that's
sure.
how mm-hmm. these systems continue to work. But it does send a message to white people who might want to show up for the next protest when, if Kyle Rittenhouse is acquitted. I don't want to go there. You know, I might be in danger. And right. so then there's the optics now that it's just people of color protesting, and we don't have the same ability to sway the public opinion, because now this thing has happened. People are now scared to protest and to share their true views about equality and equity and how Black lives actually do matter. And, you know, there's a chilling impact.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it certainly wouldn't be the first time that vigilante violence has been used to quell a social movement in the United States. The only thing that changes is the date. The participants always seem to be the same, right? It's usually white folks on one side trying to stamp out any attempt by folks of color to organize themselves, improve their lot, participate more fully in the franchise. This is as American as apple pie, folks. And if this verdict goes in favor of young Mr. Rittenhouse, the boy murderer, as I said before, we can expect a whole lot more of this sort of thing going forward. What I'd like to do, let's go take a call. And after that, I want to dig into the many ways in which white privilege has shown up in the context of the Rittenhouse trial. So let's go to Jeremy. Good morning, Jeremy.
Hi. I just wanted to correct you, Tracy. Jacob Blake is very much alive. He's paralyzed, but if you Google him, the first thing that comes up is he's hoping to walk again. And so I think it does not serve, you know, anybody's movement toward any sort of social justice to be that loose with the facts. And one of the things that bothered me, I've protested every police killing in the last 20 years in Portland since I moved here, and I was doing similar stuff in the Bay Area beforehand. But there were a couple of killings that seemed like second-degree murder to me. George Floyd was certainly second-degree murder. I think every cop, you know, that every single killing in Portland, I don't think any of them were justified. They all should have been fired. All or almost all of them deserve some jail time. But it does not serve the movement to gain control of the police. I actually have no trouble with the phrase defund the police, although it didn't work real well strategically. But I like that it's aggressive and shows. I mean, if you look at the roots of police forces in the United States as fugitive slave capturers, you know, mm-hmm. this is you know, having an armed right wing gang with you know, insanely wide power is not good for the rest of us. You know, they break strikes, they protect rich people. This is not a group we need to be rousting homeless people anyway. But I think that the loose and overuse of the word murder to describe police killings, most of them are manslaughters. Some of them are just, you know, dumbass undertrained cops coming out of the military, maybe on steroids, shooting somebody mm-hmm. when they should have de-escalated. I don't think they're wanting to kill people. Often they don't mind killing people, and they all should lose their jobs, and many of them should go to jail. But calling them all murderers is an exaggeration that anybody who knows.
Point taken. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Let's go to Tawazi. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. You know, racism in trials and courts is such a glaring problem. It's as an indigenous person, it's been just ongoing since the beginning, since the first colonizers arrived and they justified their killings in court. But the reason I'm calling today is because of the glaring racism in law enforcement here in Portland. Do you guys remember the case of Mohammed Mahmoud, or maybe it's Mahmoud Mohammed or something like that? the first name is really similar to the second. And he was a young man that got radicalized by the FBI. He was given a bomb that had a fake detonator to blow up at Pioneer Square. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think he got life in prison. Like, he got a huge, long sentence for not blowing up a bomb. However, another person in Portland did blow up a bomb and effectively exploded an IED, multiple IEDs, in a public park, in Laurelhurst Park, but their attack was against racial justice protesters. And that person also is a police trainer and Caucasian. So they spent zero days or nights in jail. As far as I know, they weren't ever taken into custody. And there's no action by the district attorney against the man who blew up bombs inside of Portland. So, you know, whether it's because Mohammed Mahmoud was, a Muslim man of Middle Eastern descent, or maybe it's because Garrick Fernbaugh is a white man of Caucasian descent, who knows? But I think that racism in law enforcement is apparent just in that one instance of similar cases inside of the same jurisdiction. So I just want to point those out to you guys. And, you know, that's just one set of cases.
Now, imagine how much worse all that's going to be if you can call it self-defense.
Yeah, well, I mean, you take a look again, within the same time frame, within the same jurisdiction, they have this guy Malik. They're looking at giving him 30 years for the use of an explosive device. But again, Garrick Fernbaugh used multiple explosive devices, but Malik is not Fernbaugh. The only difference being that one was carrying out an attack in support of police, and the other one was carrying out an attack against, you know, systems of oppression. So anyway, I appreciate you guys facilitating these conversations, and thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for having.
Let's go to Tony. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well. What's on your mind?
Good. Well, I just wanted to first to say I appreciate your show very much, and it's a great contribution, and thank you for doing that. I just wanted to kind of echo what one of the previous callers said about the importance of using care with our use of language. And personally, although I 90% of the time agree with you folks, I do take offense at referring to Kyle Rittenhouse as a boy murderer. I think we should afford anyone who's accused of a crime, the right to first be tried and convicted of something before we throw those words around. And, you know, I can't help but think, what if that had been a Proud Boys rally, and what if that had been a leftist Antifa supporter on the ground fighting for his life, perhaps? And I just don't think that you would use the term boy murderer for a 17-year-old Antifa protester. So just food for thought, and I think it weakens the movement.
Oh, are you there? Okay.
Wow. Okay. I think
we lost him.
I think that's all I have to say. Something to think about. That's all I have to say. But I love you guys. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Okay. Fair enough. Let's afford young Mr. Rittenhouse but his right to a trial before we call him a murderer.
Okay. You. I didn't call him a murderer.
Before I call him a murderer. Okay.
But I have it's interesting. And just thinking about even calling him a boy. He is no longer a minor. And what's interesting for me as a black person is that we are not afforded such luxury to be even identified as boys and girls past, you know, an age where we are, you know, 4 foot tall. What's interesting is that, you know, we've heard, you know, Donald Trump Jr., who is, you know, my age, be called a boy. There's something about white innocence, the privilege of white innocence, that allows us to see younger people who are white as children and really give them, you know, the benefit of the doubt from that space of, you know, they didn't know better, they're young and dumb, they made some bad choices, right? We do that all the time. But when we look at, you know, like Trayvon Martin, who was 15, he was a very tall, young boy, but also was adultified, right? And seen as a grown man in the trial where he was killed, he was murdered. Sorry, I don't really care if someone was convicted, when we all know what it was, right? We're talking about George Zimmerman killed Trayvon Martin, who was also unarmed. And in this case, right, you see this adultification of black boys and girls and the innocence projected onto white boys and girls or younger people.
Yeah.
That just doesn't happen. That's not afforded to other people. And I did want to just mention that because, yes, in the discourse, people continue to refer to him as a boy. And, you know, maybe when he did this terrible thing, you know, and I think it's terrible, sorry, I'm not going to show up anywhere with a rifle and not think that you're going to make other people feel like they need to protect themselves in self-defense. Because if no one else is carrying open weapons, right, you're gonna create for people an anxiety, a sense that they might be under attack. And we none of us were there, so we don't know all of the situation. There's a video out. If you'd like to watch it, please, you know, take care of yourselves. But, you know, I don't think we can really pinpoint what in that space, you know, happened. And it's just really important to step back. And at the same time, if I want to call it what I see it as, I'm going to call it that. And I don't know that it is a murder in the legal sense, because, of course, self-defense is a squishy idea. And my point is, it's a squishy idea for some defendants. It's a squishy idea because it doesn't stick for some defendants. And oftentimes, those defendants are people of color.
Yeah, absolutely right. That's also a perfect segue into the many ways that white privilege have made themselves visible during the Rittenhouse trial. So let's look at that a little bit. If you'd like to take part in the conversation, 503-231-8187 is the number to call. So you just talked about how when it's a young white man who perpetrates a crime like this, Tracy, that he is infantilized, you know, and made to seem like a wayward youth rather than someone, you know, in full control of their actions. And that started happening even before the trial. Donald Trump, president at the time, piped up to say that if Rittenhouse hadn't killed two people, that he himself would probably have been killed. Don Jr., whom everybody waits to hear from on every possible subject, noted that we all do stupid things at 17. I killed a few people at 17. Doesn't everybody? Great. So yeah, there's the infantilization. There's the making excuses for violent actions because somebody's young, because somebody's white. And that was even before the trial began. And after the trial began, it became clear quite early that Rittenhouse had another ally in the courtroom, and that was the judge, a guy by the name of Schroeder. Before the trial even began, this was in pretrial motions, Schroeder refused to allow prosecutors to refer to the people Rittenhouse killed as victims, claiming that it was too loaded of a term. So here's what justice correspondent Ellie Mistel at The Nation wrote about that decision. I'm going to read you Mr. Mistel's quote here. I can absolutely see the argument that using the term in a case where the defendant claims self-defense lacks neutrality. It's a choice other judges have made, though I doubt that this kind of neutrality would be given to a black teen who gunned down people at a MAGA rally. Still, I wouldn't call Judge Schroeder biased for this ruling alone. I call Schroeder biased because of this, at the same conference at which he decided to prohibit the prosecution from using the word victims to describe the people Rittenhouse shot, he said he would allow the defense to use words like rioters, looters, and arsonists to describe these same people. The victims are not on trial, Mistel writes. Rittenhouse is. Refusing to allow prosecutors to use linguistically accurate terms for people who did not voluntarily attempt to catch a bullet with their face at the same time is allowing the defense to use prejudicial language to characterize what those people were doing at the time is the very definition of bias. So, yeah, that is absolutely biased. No, He didn't shoot victims. He shot rioters. He shot looters. He shot arsonists. This is immediately before the trial even begins, painting Rittenhouse in a kindly light. Before the trial even began, again, Schroeder let Rittenhouse out on a $2 million bond, which was crowdfunded by a bunch of people using the internet who thought what Rittenhouse did was just great. So they decided to get together, pool their money, and get him out on bail. While he was out on bail, Rittenhouse was photographed wearing a T-shirt that read, "Free as F." The judge also disallowed the inclusion of that piece of evidence into the trial. Here's Mistel writing again. At the same time, Schroeder announced that he would not allow prosecutors to introduce evidence of Rittenhouse's prior disposition to shoot people to death. There is a video of Rittenhouse watching from a car as people leave a CVS pharmacy. He calls them looters and says that he wishes he had a gun to shoot them. The video was taken in August 2020, about 2.5 weeks before Rittenhouse shot up the streets of Kenosha. There are also photos from January of the same year of Rittenhouse posing with members of the Proud Boys. Both the video and the photos will be excluded from the trial. But the police patting Rittenhouse on the head, the premises, will be included. And he's referring there to when a police officer on the night that Rittenhouse killed two people in Kenosha, Wisconsin, gave him a drink of water and thanked him for being there. So all of this happened before the trial even got going. As the trial progressed, the judge snapped at the prosecution for asking Rittenhouse why he thought he needed to carry an AR-15 to protect himself. He didn't allow that line of questioning to continue. He also, during that same day, excluded the picture that I was just talking about a little while ago. So you see, from top to bottom, before the trial even begins, prominent white people in the community, including the President of the United States and his son, defending a killer for his actions, and then the judge in his trial refusing to even acknowledge the people killed as victims. This is how white supremacy works. This is how white privilege works. And this is why you can expect to be treated much more leniently if you go and shoot somebody and your skin happens to be white. And if Kyle Rittenhouse is acquitted in this trial, as I'm going to observe once again on this program, you can expect a whole lot more of this going forward. So this leaves us at a crossroads, and this is something I've been trying to get across over the course of this program, and I think we've managed to do that. Tracy had to leave to attend to an appointment, so I'll be bringing the show home all on my lonesome. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. As I mentioned earlier, the verdict in this case and the verdict in the Ahmaud Arbery case is going to answer the question for white people, when do we get to use the gun? Now, that may seem like a moot question to many people because you look around and clearly people are using the guns. They are using the guns all over the place. The question, perhaps more accurately, is when can we use the guns in defense of what we perceive to be our rightful position at the center of political, economic, and social power in the United States? When do we get to use the guns in defense of the racial hierarchy that has plagued this country since before its founding? When do we get to use the guns in defense of white supremacy? The answer to that question is going to determine how our political discourse plays out nationally over the coming months. We have an election next year. 2 years after that, a presidential election. And if at every rally that takes place between now and then, people on the right side of the political equation feel entitled to carry weapons of war, or at least weapons that very closely resemble in form and function weapons of war, into these protests, as Tracy mentioned, that will bring a chilling effect to people's political participation on the ground, in writing, at the polling place, and everywhere else. This marks a turning point. I'm going to make some metaphors here. A turning point on a slippery slope. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. We've spent most of our time talking about the Rittenhouse trial this morning, and I think that's appropriate. But the Ahmaud Arbery trial, which, as we've talked about, is going on at the same time, is worthy of our attention too. for slightly different reasons, although associated reasons, to those that we should follow the Rittenhouse trial. Ahmaud Arbery, as Tracy mentioned earlier, was jogging through his neighborhood in Georgia. He jogged near the site of a house under construction that had been rumored to have been burglarized, continued on his jog, and was spied by some white residents of the area who believed he might have had something to do with the burglarization of that construction site, based presumably on the fact that his skin was black and he happened to be in the area. So here's Ahmaud Arbery jogging by, and these three white men pile into two different vehicles and start chasing him down. Chasing him down as he ran on foot through the streets of his community, until finally they cut him off. A couple of men leaped out of the pickup truck they were following him with and shot him dead. That's what we're talking about. Now, if the Rittenhouse verdict goes in young Kyle's favor, and it is judged that he was acting in self-defense, it's not that big of a stretch to see the verdict in the Arbery trial come out in a similar way. Maybe he wasn't, maybe his killers weren't acting in self-defense, but certainly they were defending property in their neighborhood. Certainly they were defending the civic virtue of their community. Never mind the fact that they hopped in a pickup truck and hunted a man down and shot him until he was dead. So you should be paying attention, progressives, to the outcomes of these two verdicts, because they are going to determine the future of political discourse in this country. Or maybe I'm exaggerating. Maybe this is overblown. Maybe we've left that turning point in the dust. Maybe it's already time for people to use the guns. Maybe people have already made that decision. Maybe that switch has already been flipped in their heads. Maybe we're there already. Maybe I'm being naive, and we can expect mass political violence going forward, regardless of how these trials turn out. And you know what? Now I think about it, I think that's true to a certain extent. The governor in Wisconsin has already put 500 National Guard on alert pending the outcome of the Rittenhouse trial. Now, it forces you to wonder, which direction is that going to go? What are these troops going to do if Kyle Rittenhouse is found not guilty? I think we can expect those troops to come out and crack down on the people of color and their allies who turn out to protest the verdict. If Kyle Rittenhouse is found guilty, I expect you'll find a lot of right-wingers out there protesting the verdict, and you will also see those National Guard troops on the street, but I suspect that their aims will not be quite the same as if the verdict had gone the other way. I guess we'll have to wait and see. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Robbie, good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Great. Yeah, I just wanted to bring up, you know, the an even kind of larger scope of things. First and foremost, I'm an abolitionist activist.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can remember when Derek Chauvin, I think that's his name, you know, was, mm-hmm. you know, found guilty, I don't want to say that I didn't want to see him get guilty, but me being an abolitionist, you know, looking at this larger picture, it's like, first of all, he was the only one that
means. Can you pause for a second and explain what being an abolitionist activist means?
You don't know what abolitionism means?
No, I'm just hoping you could explain it for our listeners who might not know.
Okay. Well, basically, I'm against the private prison industry. I don't think that mm-hmm. if we follow what other nations are doing, you'll see that their corrective, you know, departments have, you know, like I'm confused. It's like, I thought you were a progressive here. Maybe you could explain abolition a little bit better, but basically it's recognizing that the private prison industry is doing harm and providing
what it is you wanted to abolish. Okay. Go ahead, please.
Okay. And you know, in terms of that, you know, I mean, the private prison industry does still have, you know, use slave labor under it. At any rate, what I'm finding here is that, you know, we're given these little breadcrumbs, as I like to call in and say, you know, we're all happy Derek Chauvin got arrested, you know, and tried guilty for, you know, murdering George Floyd. But that's not enough. And I'm not trying to say like we need to punish Derek Chauvin. Who are the medical doctors, the autopsy people who did the autopsy on George Floyd and said, oh, you know, it was this? You know, who were the people that allowed that type of stuff to go on? You know, those are the people that if you want to have, you know, this society, this grand experiment of democracy where, you know, we can do that, we need to be holding those people accountable. But all too often what I find happening is, you know, probably much like in this case, you know, Rittenhouse or, you know, whatever, it's like, well, you're right on one end, like this is going to pan out a lot differently than the Derek Chauvin stuff. But what I find is that that system maintains itself through our support of it.
Yeah, I think you're getting at something similar to the point Tony was trying to make earlier, that there's a whole system of supremacy that underlies all of this. It's not just the cops, it's the clerks. It's the people who perform the autopsy, like you said. It's the people who push the paper. All of this conspires to uphold a system that keeps, that privileges one group of people and oppresses another.
Look at the January 6th. Look at the January 6th, you know, insurrection, takeover, whatever you want to call it. There was FBI, DHS handprints all over that. And how many suicided cops? I don't see how we can hold this system accountable using the system. This is like trying to go through, you know what I'm trying to say? It's like using internal affairs to try to get justice for police brutality. It doesn't happen. I've had to do it before, and I found out the hard way, you know, in 2009, that doesn't work. But I don't know. I just wanted to leave that in people's heads because I, you know, when we're falling for these, oh, great, you know, Derek Chauvin got arrested. Well, you know, okay, well, now he's just going to be the leader of some white supremacy gang in prison now. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
I mean, I don't want that. I don't wish that. I'm just saying, you know, it's like I wish we could kind of look at the larger scope and try to start building these systems which are outside this system, which supports the same thing that you know, come on here and you're like, oh my gosh, this system's so bad. Well, let's start doing something about it. Let's start building what we want to see. And, you know, I mean, I know I'm not in this national case, but I think if we're going to try to get to this point where, you know, we're all living in a just society, I think it's going to start with us starting to make it and stop relying on, you know, on these others.
All right. Listen, man, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Rodney brought up the January 6th insurrection. I'm glad he did, because I had been hoping to be able to connect what we're talking about today with that event and the likelihood of a similar event in the future. Let's think about this. The January 6th incursion, insurrection, coup attempt, whatever you want to call it, it failed largely because it was not very well organized, nor was it very well led, nor was enough supporting apparatus in place to pull it off. They came pretty damn close. They gave it a good run, but they failed largely because they were kind of stumbling fools, led by the biggest stumbling fool of them all at the top. But they made it clear. They have made it clear that they are going to try this again. Donald Trump is going to be the Republican nominee for president in the next presidential election. He is going to be to face the will of the voters once again. And if he loses, which he most likely will, he will not accept that loss, nor will his followers. And this time, their coup attempt is going to be a much better one, a much more effective one, in all likelihood, a much larger one and better organized one. And if these trial verdicts go in favor of these people who committed murder, I know we're quibbling about the niceties of that term, if it goes in their favor, then a lot of these people who will take part in the next coup attempt at the U.S. Capitol will be able to claim the mantle of self-defense if they happen to kill anybody. But it may be a moot point by then, because they will have succeeded and they will have installed, against the will of the voters and in contravention of electoral procedure and policy in the United States, someone who didn't actually win the presidency. And then our republic will have ended. Am I saying that the future of the republic depends upon these verdicts? No, I am not. I'm saying these verdicts are going to influence how our discourse unfolds between now and the next presidential election. And if you don't think they're not going to try to topple the government again, then you have not been paying attention. That's the point I'm trying to make. All right. I'm certain we're going to revisit this. I will know the outcome most likely of at least one of these trials by the time we return next week, so we will bring you an update. In the meantime, thank you for tuning in. This has been Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. My name is Abe Proctor, and for my co-host, Tracy Simmons, thank you for tuning in, and we will be back at you.
This is Constance Sharp of Rock to Recovery and co-author of the book Rock to Recovery: Music as a Catalyst for Human Transformation with Les Gear, asking you to tune in to KBOO on Monday, November 22nd at 11 p.m. for Eclectic Pandemic here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This is David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Today, we have many COVID deniers.